I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Listen up, dear listeners in the UK. There's a brand new guitar show this year, the Brighton Guitar Show. It's a one-day show happening on the 15th of July at the Brighton Racecourse, and it's going to be great. We'll be there along with loads of your favourite boutique and major brands like Two Notes Audio Engineering, Chapman Guitars, Fidelity Guitars, Thought BFX, Pedal Patch, Bright Onion Pedals, Ranger FX, NRG FX, Great Eastern FX, Iverson Guitars, Kurt Mangan Strings, Mayberry, Leighton, Lemon Audio, Xander Circuitry, and loads more. What more excuse do you need to come to sunny Brighton, the birthplace of guitar nerds, than a guitar show full of guitars, pedals, effects, and accessories? Come say hi, hang out, have a beer, and check out all the cool gear with Matt, JD, and I. You might even see a few of the OG Guitar Nerds hosts knocking about. For tickets, visit brightonguitarshow.co.uk or check them out on social media with Brighton Guitar Show. See you there. Here at Guitar Nerds, we're big fans of iZotope software and their impressive range of plugins. And you, dear listener, get 10% off all iZotope plugins at iZotope.com with discount code NERDS10. Every Guitar Nerds podcast for well over 5 of its 10 years has been edited, polished, and repaired using iZotope's wonderful range of tools. From their Nectar suite to EQ, compress, and lightly add reverb to give the impression that Matt and I are in the same room, to the RX repair suite to deal with pops, clicks, and background noise. In fact, every sound sample that you hear on our podcast is mastered using iZotope's Ozone Mastering Suite, and I can even compare audio, EQ, and levels to other similar released material using iZotope's Tonal Recall. It's all very good, and believe it or not, there are a bunch of free plugins that you can try. A vinyl simulator for added character, the Ozone Imager for help visualizing your stereo mix, and a vocal doubler for added richness and depth to your vocals. Pretty neat. Check it all out at iZotope.com. So Dan, I finally got round on Netflix to watching that documentary on clocks the other day. It was about time. Hello, dear listener. Hello and welcome to another episode of the Guitar Nerds Podcast. I am your host, Joe Branton, joined this week by Dan Gooday. Dan, hello. Welcome to the podcast. Thanks for joining me.
Hello, Joe. Yeah, nice to thank you for having me, and yeah, nice to join you.
Yeah, exactly. Now, Dan hasn't done an episode of Guitar Nerds before, dear listener. This is your maiden voyage with us. But we've actually known each other and been friends for quite a few years now. Dan is, dear listener, what is your official title at Ashdown these days?
Official title is Managing Director of Ashdown, but for all intents and purposes, we're a family business. So titles are one thing to one and another to another.
I see. Okay. Well, yes. So Dan basically heads up and runs Ashdown Engineering, dear listener, but he is also a verified guitar nerd. So I thought what an excellent fit to have on the podcast this week, whilst Matt is off gallivanting around Europe. with work. So this week, kind of, I over the last couple of weeks, we've been talking about NAMM, talking about all the new products that have come out. It was a little bit muted, missing some of the big hitters, but there were a few exciting products that have come out. And of course, Dan, you actually got to go to NAMM, so you got to see some of the cool things were there. You actually there was an Ashdown booth at NAMM this year that I saw lots of videos of you like having to go to IKEA at some ridiculous time of the morning to get things to build a stand.
Yeah, I mean, as with NAMM, it's always a fun last minute dash, and there's always something that doesn't turn up or something that doesn't go to plan that you end up just having to deal with as you get there. And some of the expenses incurred at NAMM are just daft when you look at it. I mean, we wanted to rent two sofas and a coffee table for 3 days at NAMM, right?
Yeah.
$3,500 the wonderful people at Freeman wanted to charge us for the rental of that.
What, is that the official company that rent things for NAMM, is it?
Yeah, that's the people with the monopoly, because it's all union based and everything that goes with it. So we have to use their suppliers if we want to rent stuff. However, there is an IKEA down the road in Costa Mesa. IKEA, there are other flat pack furniture providers, but we do tend to favour IKEA. and for $800, we got two sofas, a coffee table, and extension leads and various other bits. And sadly, it was donated at the end of the show to a good cause.
Oh, that's good. I saw your dad post a picture being like, oh, I hope someone picks some of this stuff up.
By donated.
That's always. I wonder how much stuff, I wonder how many people do that sort of thing at NAMM, because you can't be the only people who've worked out there's an IKEA around the corner.
No, we've built whole booths out of IKEA furniture before, from giant structures using this massive Kallax system. We've shipped in. We've probably built around about 40 to 50 of these Kallax units at NAMM and left them there.
That unit type must keep, sorry, dear listener, to make it the furniture podcast, but Kallax by IKEA must keep that company in business, because...
Well, it's the perfect size for everything. I mean, those squares that Kallax fits turntables, and it just so happens to fit most of our headphones, products, and all sorts in between. So it's a great... piece of furniture.
There's that, and we're going to talk about sort of Ashdown Labs and some of the weirder things that you've been involved in, like prototyping later in the podcast. But there is, at Ashdown HQ, dear listener, there's some sort of Ashdown like sub that fits perfectly into one of those Kallax boxes.
It's designed in mind, actually, at the time. It was the height of the feet, and I'm looking at it now across the room, and it does fit perfectly snug within that cube. Some of the stuff that we've designed over the years and some of the stuff that we've been involved in is... you've got to laugh a little bit, but in the same instance, it's also what keeps us driving forward in terms of innovation and ideas. And it's also something that inspires me, really. Gear's always been a massive part of my life growing up in this industry.
Absolutely. I bet. Well, this is the thing, because Ashdown is such a family-run business, because your entire life and your dad's entire life has been being in this industry and kind of trying to make new things that, make the next thing for bass players or, guitarists, anyone, musicians in general. It's something that you're heavy. I mean, how many shows do you reckon you've done over the years? Because you must have been doing them since you were a kid.
My first Frankfurt show, I think, was I was about 9 years old. Subsequently, I don't know, this was in my official capacity, would have been my 20th NAMM show. With that in mind, it's sort of 20 years of trade shows. They used to be 2 to 3 a year, and then including Music China and others that we ended up doing. So a lot. Upwards of 70 odd, if not 100 plus sort of international trade shows around the world.
That would definitely be
a figure that
Do you still like them? Do you still like them, or have you got very bored of trade shows by this point?
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit BetterHelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
Burrow's furniture is built for the way you live. From ensuring easy assembly and disassembly to honoring highly requested new colors for their award-winning seating, they always have their customers in mind. Their modular seating is made out of durable materials to last and grow with you. And with Burrow, you always get fast, free shipping. Get up to 60% off during Burrow's Memorial Day sale at burrow.com/ACAST. That's burrow.com/ACAST. burrow.com/ACAST.
There's a love-hate relationship. I couldn't imagine not doing them. Yeah. But in the same instance, if there was an opportunity not to do it in such the way that we've broken our backs over it. Like, this NAMM was perfect. It was just me and Dad flew out and set up a booth within a couple of hours. And it was an easy breakdown. Everything was there waiting. But some years, I mean, we've taken out sort of 24 410s, 24 412s, drove in a London double-decker bus one year, years.
I remember that. I
had to drive in before anyone else in the convention centre. Yeah, we had to drain the fuel on it and then get it approved by the fire marshals, have it on axle stands. You end up getting a good relationship with the foreman on the floors at the show, so we still know the same foreman that I've known for 20 plus years. He still looks after that hall. It was great seeing him at the show. And again, shows are just great for connecting with people that you wouldn't necessarily get the opportunity to spend any time with. So one thing that we always asked is it worth it? Is it really worth the money? And we saw 32 customers from around the world whilst we were there over 3 days, over 60 odd people. And you start adding up how much that would cost to visit those individually.
Yeah.
It's still a good viable option. And as much as the virtual world has achieved X for trade shows, I still think it's important to press the flesh and see people and kind of gauge that whole vibe, because it is our industry. We are an industry based on hype. Whether you believe it or not, it's your choice.
That's my entire job.
absolutely. Definitely worth it. It's a
How
great
do you think
show.
It compared? How do you think that this NAMM compared to like other NAMMs in the past?
Well, someone said to me on whenever it was the Friday of the show, just talking, said it feels like 20 years ago. And I was sat there thinking, I can't remember. Oh, no, I was here 20 years ago. Yeah, actually, it does. It didn't have quite the expense and the over exaggeration that it became about sort of 5-6 years ago, where everyone was just going all out with demonstrators.
It had become over the last few years. It had kind of changed. It wasn't really about a good product being launched there. It was about getting a YouTuber with a couple of million followers to play a 30-string guitar. Like, it was about gimmick releases. It really changed to sort of where the focus was, you know.
I think it's all for the better, to be honest, because a lot of that noise that is created by others, not just actual physical noise, because it does get deafening, but actual just the noise from others at the show. For us as a sort of a mid-sized brand, it enabled us the time with people we wouldn't have necessarily had otherwise. So filtering out that noise and not making it a big showboating experience. And I get it. It's all about being seen. But this day and age, I think it's still very important to be there, but in a cost-effective manner, that we're not going back thinking, oh, I've just spent our first quarter's budget on NAMM.
Well, that is it. That was the biggest thing about, and you know, dear listener, I'm aware that Matt and I have talked about, you know, this a bunch, and whether or not NAMM's worth it now. The amount of money that it costs brands to head out there can be cripplingly expensive. So I like that the shoe's on the other foot now, that brands don't feel that they have to do it, but there is still advantage. Like, it's interesting hearing what you've got to say about it, because...
Yeah, I mean, it's what you choose to do with it, because you can still spend the money. You can still have the big flash booth. I mean, one of the most impressive structures this year was the new GSP booth at the show, and it was great to see the industry kind of still spending that sort of money.
Well, I mean, Neural DSP must have a lot of money. I mean, they only have to make a product once, and then they can sell it over. That's the benefit of plugins, you know.
A digital world that if we didn't have to have a physical product, if we didn't have to manufacture stuff, that'd be wonderful. But we do, and without doing that, it's difficult. But
what did Neural DSP have there then, other than the? Just the pedal board?
Yeah, I think so. I didn't really spend much time, to be honest, but they had a big screen, a little demo area. John and Rabir were there playing, which was great. I think they were one of the only companies to have proper demonstrators on the booth. It was all very headphone-orientated, as you can imagine.
Yeah, sure.
But then again... It was an odd show. A lot of weird little guitar makers popping up. A friend of mine that does some great instruments, and for the life of me, I've forgotten his name.
That's the benefit of
Avi.
Avi, right.
And he makes guitars in California. We actually met him at Mannheim.
Guitar Summit. Was it Shabbat?
It was Shabbat.
Yeah, there you go. How about that?
Avi Shabbat. And he had a great show and sold out most of the instruments that were on the booth. And then catching up with the lovely Ken Haas from Reverend Guitars, and some of the instruments that he's coming out with are phenomenal. We had a little ashdown on his booth, so it was nice chatting with him. And it's nice seeing sort of, I don't know, you still got the feedback from people, it being their first NAMM, and how excited they were still to be there. And I was just thinking, I'm sorry. I just kept apologizing for them being their first NAMM was this year, because the size of the corridors, the hall, it was half the show it has been.
Had they shrunk it down? Blocked
off basement, blocked off half of hall C. Moved the drums in with Hall C. Hall D became kind of, there was a big Chinese factory presence at the show with sort of a Chinese manufacturing marquee that gets set up for them, so they have an opportunity to showcase their goods, which are normally reserved for the basement at NAMM. And that's always been my favourite place at NAMM. And it's always
You see such weird stuff.
That's amazing. I remember seeing the little Kinect MIDI boxes that were being done at the time, and it was all touch sensitive MIDI controllers and various other bits, and it's all started to come to the forefront and into fruition. But that was sort of 6-7 years ago. Right. I remember seeing these weird tin can basses as well down there at one point that now are all over. Sort of Urban Outfitters across America and other retail chains as such, just doing kind of the toy instrument market. It's just great to see. But that was lacking at the show, any sense of sort of...
The weirder stuff, the more outlandish stuff. That's a shame.
It was nice to see the guys from Dingwall, because I still think they make some incredible basses. I'm not too sure about the fanfets, but they work with that instrument. I thought I'd never be able to play one of these, and then sat down with a four string for a little while thinking, actually, you know what, this is quite nice.
Cool. They're very well built. I mean, they're absolutely the opposite of everything that I like in a bass. But I really like them for kind of for innovation, you know, sort of making a fan fret bass. They are very modern, but they're kind of keeping some traditional edge. Like a lot of them have scratch plates still, those big angled humbuckers. They're kind of cool. Like they're quirky cool.
They are. And Sheldon's doing a great job with that. And they're shipping and he's making a lot of basses, and they are still handmade.
What was the brands that Lodestone, the original Ashdown bass back in the day? Because this is a thing that's interesting. Dear listener, Dan ends up and I assume it's you, and you know, we'll talk about Dave Green and his eccentricities as well. But I assume it's you who always heads up kind of the Ashdown Lab stuff that tends to be very progressive. Like the products that come out of Ashdown Labs, they tend to be the weirder things, left field things. You know, if the Ashdown ABM is an absolute sort of cornerstone of what a rock and roll bass head is, there'll be weird oddities that will come out. Like there was that programmable head.
Yeah, the Superfly, that was the first one. In fact, I've got one sat behind me at the moment on the floor. That was kind of inspired. My old man's always been one to run with an idea. Right. Some might say get carried away. I'm for the opinion that it's always... Dad listens an awful lot to what his friends have to say. And I think a lot of what we've built upon as a company is we've always taken other people's opinions and we've taken them to heart a lot of the time. We've taken them to production a lot of the time. And it's nice to just experiment. So a lot of that's fed by my dad's passion for evolving with the times and listening to what the artist has to say. And same with myself. And then some opportunities like touching back onto the Lodestone Guitar Project. That was actually a collaboration at the time with our marketing company, a company called The Bridge, based out of Milton Keynes. A guy called Jeff Howarth and a guy called Andy. And they helped with that. They were involved in the initial idea. And the idea, it was just B&W just launched their 3 series, revamped, and they had some cool angles and lines and some really cool colours. And we went down that route of looking at that aesthetic and then, again, not wanting to do a guitar that was just another guitar. We decided to look at the material aspect of things and started looking at ceramics for saddles and nuts, which has its benefits, more so for saddles than it does for nuts. Nuts, you need a little bit more lubrication than is available between a string and a piece of stone.
Sure.
At one point we were getting sparks off of nuts because of the way that the tension was at the top. So, and then again, the weird and wonderful headstock that was inspired by my father's time at his previous entity, which was Trace Elliott back in the day. They did a bass called the T-Bass.
Oh, the Trace Bass, yeah.
Yeah, which was ergonomically designed to enable the bass player to tune at a more comfortable position, but also creating a better tension at the nuts.
I didn't realize that the T-Bass also had the weird angle on the... So what Dan's talking about, dear listener, is if you think about on like a Fender P-Bass, how you've got to reach over, or, you know, a guitar as well, a Strat, because the Lodestones existed as guitars as well as basses. But if you, you know, if you have to lift your hand over the top to tune, then these were at a slightly recessed angle, so angled slightly back. Still on the top of the headstock. I don't mean angled back like a Firebird, but you know, slightly angled back so that it was a comfortable location for you to get. And it, and what did it do? Just extend the
tension at the nut. Yeah, so it just increased that tension, proved better stability within tuning, and then got involved with carbon truss rods and reinforcement in that, and in the design of that. We worked with a great factory over in Czech Republic called NRE, a guy called Peter there and his wife. Wonderful factory. They build a lot for NS Design products and Spectre products.
That I was going to say, there. I bet if it's the Czech Republic and it's a factory, I bet they do a load of Spectre. Yeah,
a phenomenal factory, great access to some incredible woods and materials. And then, yeah, I mean, that was back in 2007, I think we launched them.
Right.
And we'd just done a huge campaign at the time with the wonderful people at Sound Control, who had committed to the line in a big way, and it was all being a big port. And then literally we landed the instruments, delivered them to the stores, and then 3 days later we get a phone call from Sound Control saying, we're closing. At which point I think the look around the office was, for want of a better word, but I don't know if we're allowed to swear on the podcast, but
you can by all means.
Shit was the word that went down. We all looked at each other. Luckily, at the time, we had the retention of title in place, and they hadn't paid for the goods. So there's our sales manager, long-term Ashdown family member, Chris Bates, driving around the UK in a van, picking up guitars and anything that we could get out of the stores. And obviously, with that and what happened when they went into liquidation, it was a difficult time for us with Lodestone. And it kind of, all the effort and the attention had been put into Sound Control at the time.
Yeah.
They had their own magazine. They had their own online presence-ish. It wasn't as, Facebook was just starting. There wasn't a social media as such.
No, so it wasn't. It probably wasn't the cornerstone of promotion as it is today.
No, everything had been reviewed by Guitarist Magazine, Total Guitar. They'd all won Choice Awards, and all our advertising and efforts had gone into that. Which unfortunately, when that went under, it kind of kiboshed the entire project and everything was shelved until a later date.
Right. You've kept one for yourself that's on the rack in Ashdown HQ.
There's two. There's a Jazz and a P that I've kept. And there was a guitar at one point, but during lockdown that got sold, as did everything, really.
You kept like an Olympic white one with the Torque Guard, and it's an EMG precision pickup in it.
It was an interesting choice, but we were doing quite a lot of work at the time with EMG. And also we'd shared some time at a couple of factories far east with them at the time.
Right.
So the EMG relationship was quite strong. So we put those in, and it sounds incredible. It's a great bass. Again, with the Jazzes, we opted for an EMG Jazz option, but they were all active. And honestly, it could sound like a piano, or it could sound like a wonderfully muted Precision. It was a great instrument, and one that, for me, the necks were all based on a 62 Jazz bass that just played like butter, and then the P bass was based on a 71 P that I acquired from a guitar center actually on Hollywood Boulevard, Sunset Boulevard in Hollywood, and it was my first proper 70s P bass that I bought from there back in 2002-2003. Subsequently sold it. One of the worst decisions I've ever made. If you ever find a P bass that works, keep it.
You end up buying and selling an awful lot of stuff. I remember you had a pink Paisley Telecaster that used to kick around as well.
Recently got rid of that actually, because that was a great instrument, but that was a 2002, one of the first, 2000-ish first Fender Japan, when they did the reissues of the Telecasters, the Paisley ones. I'd always had a desire for a Telecaster, and it ended up being a gift from Fender Japan at the time. But wonderful instrument, incredible guitar. I always fell in love with the Telecaster ever since falling in love with Johnny Greenwood from a very young age. And then Colin subsequently with the P bass more so. Instruments, it's a fun world to get involved in.
Yeah, because Lodestone, of course, I guess Lodestone started the whole thing. Now you're doing the Ashdown bases. I mean, I've seen like loads of weird random Lodestones about on the secondhand market. Like I saw one today with a pair of those Sims pickups. Do you know the ones like the massive humbuckers?
Retrofitted Sims ones.
Yeah, and they're so good. Dear listener, I think these are they're expensive. They're like £200 per pickup, and you'd put two in. So it's a big expense, £400 on a pair of pickups. But they have the abilities. You've got a little switch, and there's a little LED that flashes three different light colors, and you can either split it like you would a precision bass. You can run a single bar like a jazz bass, or you can run both bars like a humbucker. So you've got three available sounds off of both pickup in any combination. They're very good. But did you ever do stuff with Sims, or is that something someone's... Oh, so that wasn't a retrofit. Well, that was actually it came.
Yeah, well, I think it might have been a retrofit because we did... Actually, Martin was involved in the first prototyping of the Lodestone instruments originally. Right. So Martin built all of our original Lodestones that we launched at NAMM back in, 2006. It was around then, 2005, 2006. It might have been later, but I'm pretty sure it was about that time.
Right.
Dates, I can't quite put a finger on it. I have to look at some old photos. But, Martin was involved in the original sort of setup and the tooling of those instruments before we moved manufacturing over to the Czech Republic. We also, at the time, I worked with a guitar tech friend of mine, a guy called Guy Cowan, who was working with the band Razorlight at the time, as well as he teched for Grant Nichols of Feeder and a few others, and just genuinely a lovely bloke that I got along really well with. So I actually ended up taking him out to the factory in near Prague and spending a week in production with them, going through everything. Making sure the setups were right, making sure that everything would function in the way it should and the instruments could intonate prior to leaving. And it was a real insight into how it needs to be done for guitar manufacturing. And subsequently, with the stuff that we've been working with Dan Lakin of Lakeland Basses, since Dan sold Lakeland to the current owners of Lakeland Basses, Dan wanted to get back involved in the industry. And we welcomed him with open arms. And,
so he's doing his own custom shop now, is right? He does a D Lakin custom builds, or sort of.
Check out D Lakin Basses for more information on that, because I'm still not 100% sure of his position with those. But drop Dan an email. Tell him Dan from Ashdown said hello.
it was a great fit, wasn't it? Because Lakeland basses are very cool. They're used by a bunch of super cool players. Geezer Butler, my favorite, and Juan Odorete, they're Lakeland players. And so it was great, especially with Dan leaving that brand. It was a cool thing to do to get them on board, but a totally different thing from Lodestone.
Completely. I mean, the thing with Lodestone, it was an opportunity at the right time. People were a bit more forthcoming to more modern shapes back then.
Right. Nowadays, is that what you think? You think it's more, it was a trend based. Now everyone's into the trad
It feels
stuff.
That way. Everything went traditional in terms of backline, if there is a backline, which is a subject that we'll get onto a little bit later. But it's that trend and changes. If something, I don't know, familiar shapes, it was always a difficult thing with the Lodestone guitars. I mean, I spent a lot of time working with Simon and James from Biffy on a Lodestone guitar at the time.
Yeah.
On the release of Puzzles. So yeah, that must have been about 2007.
My goodness, it was around Puzzles that you were doing this.
Yeah. That was the first sort of time when we started working with guitarists, and we'd built Simon one that was kind of, Simon's always been a strap man, as you know, but then trying to get him to use the super strap vibe with the humbucker at the bottom to give him that saturation, because a lot of the album was recorded with the Les Paul.
Right.
So it was trying to, I'm just bringing back loads of memories now, but I remember a time we were up in Fat Sam's up the road, and they were doing a show, doing a sound check with the low snow guitar, and it just felt right. But there was this fizz to it that with Simon's tone, with the Metal Zone, the Marshall at the time and everything else that went with that, the PV combo and a few other bits that were in that rig, it just didn't fit right. You couldn't beat the Strat for Simon's live sound with the way it was set up.
But it's such a complicated setup, Simon Hill's setup. Getting that sort of sound out of a single coil loaded Stratocaster just requires such a specific pedal board and specific amp setup that you could get that tone with a humbucking guitar. If anything, have an easier backline setup. But if you're going to try and use his weird hodgepodge of transistor and valve amplifiers and a Metal Zone, you know,
It's a difficult thing to try and achieve, and Simon was never going to be able to play a Les Paul live. It wasn't the Strat's always been comfortable,
right?
And he's quite an energetic performer, to say the least. One of the best enigmatic frontmen that I think Scotland's ever produced, let alone the UK in many instances. So it's getting that feedback there early on, and then James kind of would never be seen with one of the basses at the time because it was a little bit left field in terms of the angular design everything else that went with it.
Was he working with Fender by that point? Because he had a Squire Signature Jazz came out probably shortly after Puzzles, I reckon.
It was. Neil from Fender, and it was actually Hodder, who used to be our artist relations guy for a little while back in the day, did the bass and the guitar with James and Simon from Biffy Clyro.
Yeah.
And it was around that time, actually, not that long after. I think it was probably 2008, 2009 that came out. It was an opportunity, but it was also kind of us to get that feedback early on what was going to work and what wasn't going to work for us as a brand delving into instruments. It was interesting. And then the Dan Lakin thing came about. And then working with James on the Saint bass for the last run that we're working on at the moment, which are a more affordable range of instruments, working with an alternative factory based in China. But people are very sort of pessimistic and scared about working with factories from the Far East.
Sure. I mean, I think that's certainly changing. I think China have proved themselves to be a fantastic... Yeah, I think that the thing that the whole industry has benefited from this, but Fender introducing the Classic Vibe series, which was part of actually the Simon Neil and the James Johnston basses were kind of part of, them managing to make such high-quality instruments out of China. You know, like Matt and me have said on the podcast for years, I think loads of us have said on the podcast for years, if back when it was the Mexican standard, whatever, you know, Strat, P-Bass, anything, if you had a choice of that or a Squire Classic Vibe, get the Classic Vibe because the bang for buck was incredible.
Yeah.
But I think that's sort of moved the goalpost, changed how people think about China. So it's obvious, you know, I've mentioned Dear Listener on the podcast before about these, you know, the prototyping these new Ashdown bases out of China.
I've been blown away at the quality and the standard at which they're able to kind of maintain production. I'm intrigued about, but this particular factory do have another rather large customer that they work with that have a proven track record for affordability, a very sort of very good product, especially opting for the roasted maple boards and necks on that front. They've done it phenomenally. There's a few specification changes that we're going to need to make on a few of the instruments, as I think as we've discussed and others, but it's very impressive to see what they've done with them and moving that forward. I think the market's still very susceptible to an affordable product that's sort of, it's been road tested. And as I was getting to, it's we sent James out with one of the Chinese bases for the arena tour that Biffy Clyro did towards the end of last year. I didn't tell James where it was made. I didn't tell James how much it would cost. He fell in love with the bass at first sight and agreed to take it out on the tour. They used it for two numbers a night.
Didn't you like give it to him on the day that he played it for the first time? So this obviously, yeah. Dear listener, I imagine his tech had a look over it and, you know, gave it a few finishing touches and stuff. But that was kind of, that was one of the prototypes. So that was straight off of a boat from China to Ashdown HQ. And then you took it down to Bifficlora and he played it at an arena at you know, a base that's, you know, entry-level price point.
Yeah, they're going to probably retail around about the 399 mark. Everyone. this is not an Ashdown advert. It's encouraging to see what they can do and the consistency in which they make a good product. Yeah. We've worked in China now for about 20 years in manufacturing, and it's come a long way. We've worked with a family business based out of there, similar to our own, that have grown with us accordingly. And it's actually really quite humbling to see the processes and everything that they go through. It's not dissimilar to what we've done on what we're doing today. It's just a different level and a different scale. Yeah. China is such a vast area, and the world that they cater to is such a vast expanse. I mean, I'd love to be able to make everything back in the UK again.
You make more stuff now in the UK than you probably have for a little while.
Yeah, we make about 20% of what we sell in the UK, generally speaking.
Which is all the valve stuff.
All the valve stuff and some of the newer ABM stuff with the limited edition and the 750 that we're doing here. And then a lot of the pedals that we've done here in the past as well. All of the 18-volt Pro FX series were built here in the UK. Yeah. We've done some work with others as well, making stuff for others in the UK, which also kind of helps on that front. And it's nice to kind of get involved in little projects that we're not seen to be involved in. I think that little white label approach to manufacturing and design is something that we'll always look to do with stuff we've got our names on and stuff we haven't, from stuff from Euphonics Audio that we did back in the day, that we designed a preamp for them with our electronics engineer at the time, a guy called Clive Button, who again is an industry legend. Clive worked back in the day for the wonderful fine folk at Trace Elliott, and prior to that he's done work with everyone from Simmons drums to all sorts. Clive's always been a wonderful electronic engineer. And then tangents.
well, I'll tell you what, I was gonna ask you, because that's the thing. I don't think, I guess we've worked together for a few years now, and I'm not sure there's ever been more than a 2-week period where there hasn't been something new in research and development. That's always the thing, and it doesn't have to be like a big release for you. Sometimes it's like you're going to do this little run of something, or maybe you'll try this. Maybe this will get released on the side. And so, I guess I was. What has been your favorite like weird little thing that you've made over the years? Like something that's not the bread and butter of. I'm putting you on the spot there. One of the things that really stood out for me because of when it was released was you did a collaboration with a bass player. I can't remember the fella's name. It was a tiny little square head.
The Pie Bass. Wojciech Pilichowski.
Yeah. Was that Ashdown Design app? You've got to bear in mind when this was released, dear listener. When was it? It must have been like early 2000s, right?
Yeah, it would have been it might have been as late as 2010, actually.
Oh, really? Okay.
On the Pi Bass, particularly.
That is still before people started really playing. You think 2010, Mark Bass maybe just existed, but if they did, they were probably making their larger solid state heads then, you know, just as a reference point, you know, because after Mark Bass started going Class D, we saw loads of brands start moving towards that sort of thing. Yeah. But
and the Class D thing, I mean, that was it. I mean, the Pi Bass kind of for us, it started with the Superfly, which was way back when. That was about 2003. We came up with the Superfly, which was the first Class D programmable MIDI controllable bass amp, which we kind of got a bit carried away with the extrusion on.
There was a lot of MIDI controllability on that head at a time where most people didn't even own a MIDI controller
or switching system. No, it was incredible. I mean, that had accessible sort of 99 presets, and then there was a full parametric EQ, variable compression. It was phenomenal what you could do with the program. And that was based on a relationship that we established with a PA amp company at the time, out in China, actually, a company called Sikaku, who do some great mixers and PA systems still today. The software that we implemented from that was made available to us to kind of for bass. So we're seeing that opportunity come to light and what could be done with that. So then that was that. And then we did the MyBass, which was kind of the evolution of that, which was our first sort of commercial Class D product, which did really well. Then we did the MyBass 2.0. And then we did the PiBass, which was the collaboration with Wojciech Pilichowski, who'd been using Ashdown, massive fan of Mark King of Level 42. And bearing in mind, I grew up, bass for me has always been a status bass and a Trace Elliott. from a kid's perspective, from my youth's perspective, I suppose I've got a bit of a distorted youth than most in this industry. For me, a status bass, a Trace, or even a Lembic preamp, again, that whole Mark King element of what he achieved. And then moving
Making a bass sound like a piano, that sort of thing.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. It was making a bass sound like a piano, and they did it so well. And then kind of growing up a little bit and getting into The Who and John Entwistle's tone and everything else that kind of it transpired from that moment in time. John was also a piano man with his instruments. I mean, his gold-plated, what are the gold-plated strings? They're incredible. But on John's Buzzard bass, it was just a phenomenal thing to witness. So it's, I think going back to your subject, actually, on what's the craziest, most wonderful little invention we've done, most proudest part is the switch to valve for me.
It's actually relatively recent. Is the CTM the first all valve range? Because before
we had the BTA,
but the BTA was the
ABM preamp with the valve power section, and that was kind of the first dip of our toe into the valve market with the Little Bastard at the time, which was the original one. But yeah, coming up with that was a big departure for us. We'd never done valve amps.
The cornerstone of Ashdown was that it was hybrid solid stuff. Solid state hybrid, because that's what Trace
Blendable
was.
Blendable valve preamp. Exactly. That's kind of Ashdown sort of left off where Trace left off. Very much so within product development and everything else at the time. But yeah, R&D, that whole process. So for me, valve amplifiers, that big deep hole into valve was a big passion driven by me at the time, because it wasn't something we'd really looked at, and I was given the reins to it a little bit, and came up with these products with our chief engineer Dave Green at the time, who again Dave has worked with us since 2006. And Dave's, for those that don't know, Dave's an electronics engineer. Well, actually, he's a mechanic that owned a string of garages and then got fed up with that world and delved into electronics in his sort of late 20s, early 30s, and subsequently started working with some incredible sort of amplification brands around the world, and spent a bit of time up at Matamp and a few others. Dave's worked with us now since 2006 as our electronics engineer and design engineer, R&D engineer, service engineer. Generally speaking, Dave spends 7 days a week with us in here. But what you don't know, what he doesn't know about electronics or anything, isn't worth knowing. Dave's a wonderful soul. So, yeah, doing the valve amps for me, the Little Bastard will always hold a special place in my heart.
The original Ashdown Little Bastard must be one of the most successful products you've ever done. I actually don't know that, dear listener, as a fact. I'm guessing. I don't have access to that sort of info.
It had always done well. It never sold in dramatic numbers, but subsequent evolutions of it have.
Right.
So with the little bastard spurred the way for the CTM30 and then the CTM30 little stubby, because fundamentally everything revolved around it being a little bastard. And the little bastard came about from a bit of a morbid fascination with James Dean, actually, which inspired that. A lot of what we do as a company is inspired by motorsport, cars, and everything in between.
Cars are a big part of the Ashton. I mean, even, you know, the colour scheme, the logo, you know, it's a real, I mean, and of course the amount of different cars that you guys always buy and sell.
Yeah, cars have definitely been a passion. I think that was my father's first choice, would have been a car salesman stroke racing driver. however, he was a metal worker and got asked to design a chassis and save a company some money. And that was Trace Elliott all those years ago. and then subsequently we're here today. The Little Bastard, it was inspired by James Dean. From his last movie, Giant, he was given the nickname Little Bastard by the director of the movie, which at the time he actually drove and raced Porsche 356s. However, it was around the time Porsche just introduced the 550 Spider. It was a convertible bathtub of a car, and he was given one by Porsche, I believe, or he'd purchased one. And he had... Little Bastard scribed into the back of the car, and it was silver with red details. It was beautiful. And subsequently, that's the car that James Dean lost his life in, which inspired the aesthetic, the look, the styling, the text that he'd done. His number on the back of the car, it was either 130. It was 130 on the back of his car. And that 30 that's on there is the same styling as was on the original Little Bastard. And it was all inspired by that, the chrome and the red. Everything that came from that kind of inspired that onwards. And then recently getting to work with Two Notes Audio Engineering on the wonderful new Little Bastard 2.N has been a great little project.
It's really nice to see the Little Bastard come back as another amp. Of course, you also done the MF, which is based on the old Hayden, yes. The sister company of Ashdown, the Hayden Mofos, which were great, sort of, you know, really successful little lunchbox amplifiers right when lunchbox amps were starting to become popular. But it's nice to kind of see them back. And like I'd said, I was going to kind of talk to you about the recent news that Chris Shiflett toured the last Foo Fighters, this current Foo Fighters tour, with a Strymon Iridium instead of an amp. And you see some people moving away from amps. And dear listener, you'll be fully aware of how I feel about that. And obviously Dan is somebody who owns an amp company. But it's interesting to see. I like that the Little Bastard is sort of your answer to that, because it's a fully valve amplifier, as is the MF, you know, fully valve, 30 watts, valve preamp, valve power stage. But Two Notes are kind of they're an excellent addition, because it's not just a load box, a cab sim, you know, loaded load box as well, kind of gives you all the best of both worlds.
It's a toolkit now. It's not just a one-trick pony, where those little lunchbox amps used to sit upon wonderful furniture as such, and gigged. I mean, we had people gigging a 30 watt Little Bastard mic'd off stage, running it through a 112 or a 212 cabinet, playing arenas. Ellie Goulding's bass player actually used to tour with one. And creating it more of a toolkit rather than it just being a lunchbox was a wonderful option. And it is weird to see how the trends are going, with people moving away from backline and having something on stage, and speaking to bands that have made the switch, saying how is touring without it. And a lot of them feel like they're cheating a little bit, because of the lack of fatigue and everything else that comes without having the backline there. Because having stuff kick you in the back, whether it's sound waves or a boot, it takes its toll over a period of time. We have to kind of diversify into that simulation world a little bit, but that's well out of our comfort zone in terms of being able to support something of that nature. The wonderful people at Two Notes Audio Engineering offer a great back end and support network that's available to us as a brand to support our products, because they're supporting their own product, which gets us onto kind of the next level of where we want to take things and gear and movements. One thing that really stood out for me at the NAMM show this year, I got to walk the halls a little bit in the pro audio world, and seeing the guys at Mixwave and what they've done with the Benson amp plugin, it's a phenomenal plugin.
It's amazing. That Benson amplifier plugin is very, very hard to top. It is kind of, if you get it, dear listener, you probably don't need anything else to record guitar. It is a very good plugin.
The Chimera package, I believe it is. And it comes with all of their favorite pedals as well as the amps that work with them. Just phenomenal. It's reactive. It was expressive. I felt like it was an amplifier. It helped the monitors that they had on for the display. Some beautiful, beautiful monitors. And it sounded great. The headphones, it even sounded great through the Beyer Dynamics that we were using on the display at the time.
Right.
I can't remember the instrument I was playing it through. It was probably an ESP or something similar. But it worked. It sounded great. It gave us an opportunity as well to talk to them about the sort of future collaborations and what could be achievable for Ashdown in the virtual world.
It would be great to have, I've probably said it before, dear listener, but I'd love to have a proper Ashdown fully fledged plugin. You know, the only things you ever see for bass players are different versions of SVTs. It's like the only plugin out there.
It really is. And if we're going to be doing something similar to that, it needs to be right, because bass players, we often get the short straw when it comes to virtual gear, digital gear. We're always seen as the last thought to an extent, and even with pedals and various other bits, the market's become more fun recently, but still bass has always been an afterthought just because of the size of the market. I mean, there's 10 guitarists to every bass player, if not more. But we always get left behind, and just seeing what's available for guitarists, I'm really excited as to what the future holds for us bass players. There are modeling options out there, but I've never kind of, we did touring pre-production rehearsals with various different bands over the world that have plugged in a Kemper to start running their bass signal from, and not being able to kind of move the air that they could normally, or give the real sense of it moving air in the way it should. For me as an amplification manufacturer, you'll never be sort of a big transistor-based amplifier pushing air through an 8x10 ferrite speakers. I'm really kind of pushing the amplifier. There's nothing like it for bass. There's nothing like for plugging in a guitar amp and turning it up and making some noise for a 412. You forget, as beautiful as those things are. I mean, we plugged into a Greenback-loaded 412 here recently, with only it was a 15 watt little MF that we've got coming out, and a few other amps of choice at the time, and it was just so dynamic, responsive. I mean, you shoved any mic in front of it and it sounded beautiful. It had that sort of creamy classic tone that you could dial up and get a vibe out of. It wasn't just sort of the serving a purpose as backline seems to do these days.
Sure.
Obviously, the beauty of having a studio environment to be able to kind of delve into these things. I understand not everyone has that opportunity. So, modeling's fit a purpose and solved a problem that no one knew they had. There's always going to be a place for real amps.
Well, that was actually going to be my next question. Do you feel like there's a counterculture to that? Because I feel like it's the Ashdown Custom Shop. What was that absolutely massive bin amp that you
had to be? there is always going to be that one person that wants something to be loud and to stand out from a crowd, and that one person in this instance was Martin Glover, aka Youth of Killing Joke and producer extraordinaire. And Youth wanted something. They were doing the Killing Joke 30th anniversary tour, a show. Even it wasn't even a tour. It was a show at the Royal Albert Hall to commemorate the release of the first album 30 years ago, I believe. Or it was the concert. It was. We can check on that. it was a great thing to do. And we built basically an old folded PA system for him. A 215 folded bin with a 212 sort of high-end cabinet on top.
Was that the same as the Entwistle?
The ASS cabinets, yeah. the ASS cabinets. Very similar to those. Not exact, because unfortunately, back in 2007, our warehouse burnt down, and factory burnt down, losing all of the original drawings and the original cabinets from that. From that last Entwistle tour, we did have the option to buy some recently from an auction site that was selling John's old cabinets, but
went for too much, did they?
Went for far too much. So we tried to replicate them again. And anyway, Youth cabs. It's great being able to do custom shop bits for people, and there is a little bit of a counterculture to the digital world, especially amongst bass players.
Well, yeah, you think you look at what Guy Pratt commissioned as his signature amplifier head, the Interstellar 600. It's in a massive sort of 50s radio style chassis.
Yeah, it is, and it isn't just the older players that are going for it as well. I mean, we've recently been working with a couple of younger bands that have enjoyed having a valve amp and being able to turn it up. Getting to work with the Arctic Monkeys and various bits over the years, and getting a CTM 300 on stages with them and comparable to them using their old SVTs and various other heads that they'd take out on the tour. The Ashdown never went wrong. It was always kind of the staple. They could drive the hell out of it, and it worked night after night after night. And that's one thing I remember getting told once by a backline tech: never trust an amp you have to update. And I'm a firm believer of that to an extent. amplifiers should turn on night after night. And yes, there will be some variance in sounds, because it will depend on the room, the electrics, everything else that create that sound. But that's some of the joy and the characteristics of playing live. It's real. It's not pre-recorded. It's live. So why should the stuff that you're using be pre-recorded? I get the whole it's convenient to carry. It's a convenient thing to turn on night after night. Plug into jack cables into the back of it, straight into the PA system. Route your monitor mix into it at the same time. It's a wonderful, wonderful, wonderful thing. And I'm all for it.
Just sucks some of the fun out of it a little bit.
Just really does. I mean, tinnitus is becoming less of a problem.
There you go. That is
Hearing aids for our generation won't be as, well, not necessarily our generation, but the generation. No,
definitely not for you.
Will be a thing of the past. So it does definitely have its upsides, but there's nothing better than turning something on and making some loud noise. As a musician, it's always wonderful to kind of see your drummer's reaction, to see the guitarist's reaction when you make a big, loud, lovely noise.
Absolutely. I couldn't agree more. And anyway, on that note, that does in fact bring us to the end of this week's episode of Guitar Nerds, dear listener. If you are a Patreon supporter, head over to patreon.com/guitarnerds. Or even if you're not, sign up. You can for as little as $1 a month. Each week we do an extra episode. This week, JD and I will be talking about a bunch of stuff, some new gear that we've been buying and being taught.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Sick of being upsold at gyms?
My guy, you're currently a base member. For $90 more, I can upgrade you to our Shred membership. For $130 more, you'll be a swole member. And for just $300 more, you'll reach Sweat Platinum.
At Planet Fitness, you'll get energy without the upsell. Never pushy, always free fitness training and equipment for every workout. It's fitness that fits your budget. Join Planet Fitness for just $1 down and $10 a month. Cancel anytime. Deal ends Friday, May 10th. See Home Club for details.
Into, but head over there. If you want to get in contact with Guitar Nerds for any reason, any other social medias, obviously, or you can email us at info@guitarnerds.net. Dan, thank you so much for joining us this week. It's been lovely to have you on and have you, you know, hear all this stuff about the rather weird and full-on life that you've had in the amplification world.
Well, thank you, Joe. It's been a pleasure being on this podcast with you and catching up and talking a little bit about gear.
Yeah, there you go. Well, thanks very much. Okay, dear listeners, I'll see you over on the Patreon and we'll be back next week for more of this guitar nerdery. Farewell. Thank you, dear Patreon supporters, for listening to another episode of the Guitar Nerds podcast. Now, of course, as usual, it is time for me to thank our top tier Patreon supporters for being so amazing. Thank you to Marcus Deluxe, Suresh, Dorsonic Pickups, Chris Franklin, Anton Fryant, Russ Meehan, Barry Gresbick, Steve Davis, Daniel Walker, Jorin Brown, John Conaway, The Studio Rats, Russell Healing, Yogi the Guitarist, Ty Allen, Kyle Harris, Sean Hughes, Andy Hoffler, Eric Hemmer, Jeffrey Wax, Brian Einsler, Mark Hizau Kadawaki, Stuart Robson, Eric File, Peter Pesce, Andy Manley, Simon Milbourne, Joe Puttick, Blake Wyland, Phil Radomski, Dave Lee, Ross Edwards, Jason Wharton, James Dorr, Jake Gray, Derek Rich, Scott Kennedy, Steve Merkel, Abe Matthews, Christopher Losef, Stephen Burke, Robin Smith, Kytopia the Band, JD Short, Andy McKenzie, Brad Page, Paul Corrigan, Rob Nordvik, Scott O'Brien, and of course, Moog Gravitt.